I'm Steve Punt.
And I'm Hugh Dennis.
With us are Josh Berry, Ken Cheng, Zoe Lyons, Jess Robinson, and this is... The Now Show! Thank you very much. And so, for the first time in 96 years, we've got an election in the middle of winter. Yeah, it's cold, it's dark at 4 in the afternoon, transport systems unreliable, roads possibly icy, hard for the elderly to get around. Given all this, a major public participation event could be tricky.
In short, it's a ridiculous time of the year to have Christmas. An election, I'm not sure. The link between weather and turnout is unproven, although in really high winds, I suppose people may end up at a different polling station. But the real worry is where the polling stations will be. Many primary school halls are already booked for nativity plays, which will leave head teachers with a difficult decision.
We have come to cast our vote.
I'm afraid there is no room in the hall.
And so they cast their vote in a stable. And laid their ballot paper in a manger. Not that many schools, of course, actually have a stable.
Right, that's stuff and nonsense. Ha! All schools do, surely. Otherwise, where do they keep their polo ponies? Ha!
You see, under the election balance rules, we have to do a Jeremy Corbyn stable joke now.
So. Yeah. Yeah, although not till Parliament is dissolved, so we've got another week. Anyway, some people say parents will be upset if nativities are cancelled.
To which I say... Rubbish. No one is going to be upset unless their children are Mary or Joseph. No one really wants to take a morning off work to watch their offspring play a sheep. It's one of those things where people pretend to be upset, but secretly they are delighted.
I'm very upset that there now has to be an election.
So it's two Corbyn
two
jokes.
Two Corbyn jokes,
now,
yes. Okay, although we have got his latest poll rating, so in fact we only need one. Anyway, there is a fear that people will resent the election because it will get in the way of their preparations for Christmas.
It won't get in the way. It's on December the 12th. I think I speak for men everywhere when I say that an election on that date will not in any shape or form get in the way of my preparations for Christmas. With Prime, you don't even have to go on Amazon until the 22nd.
Yeah. And I'm delighted the election is on because we haven't had one for 2 years. That fixed-term Parliament Act is really working well.
I suspect that the Queen isn't overly impressed, though. 3 weeks ago, they made her go through a pointless Queen speech. And now, straight after she's broadcast her Christmas special and put the paper hats in the Sandringham recycling bin, she's got to go and do another one. If Johnson wins, she's apparently planning to process into the chamber, sit down, put on her glasses, say...
I refer the House to my previous speech.
Walk straight out again, pointing both index fingers at Boris and muttering...
Zing!
As she goes.
Mind you, it still took Boris 4 goes at getting an election through. He finally did it by giving up on the fixed-term Parliament Act and turning to the Consumer Protection Act instead.
Customer service.
Hello. Yes, I wonder if you can perchance help me. My parliament is broken.
Our records show you've had the parliament since June 2017. It should be under a 5-year guarantee until 2022.
Yes, but it's stuck. I won't move forward on anything.
Ah, have you tried turning it off and on again?
Yes, I got the Queen to do that, but apparently it's not legal.
Is it?
It was a burko.
Oh, well, you should have said. It's probably something to do with the amendment selection then. Okay, well, luckily for you, the 5-year guarantee does give you an option to cancel and renew.
Ah, excellent. Very glad to hear that.
And I do recommend you get rid of your burko.
Oh, don't worry. I've got a whole team working on him with screwdrivers and hammers.
We need a whole Corbyn sketch now.
I know. I know, and it's just as soon as they dissolve Parliament. Oh, and as soon as he does something. Anyway,
So exciting, so enervating is the prospect of a third election in 4.5 years that you may have missed other exciting news. For example, this week Netflix announced that TV viewers will soon have the ability to speed programmes up and get them to play at 1.5 times their actual speed, just in time for December the 12th.
Yes, at last, those 2 hours of election night speculation between the exit poll and the first action results can be made more entertaining by making it sound like it's being conducted by Alvin and the Chipmunks. But down the years, there's always been a strong relationship between elections and technology.
General election coverage tends to be delivered by the experienced senior presenters who bring to the job their gravitas and knowledge, but perhaps not of computers. In 1955, for example, they didn't seem entirely sure what a computer was.
And the buzz, or slight hum that you can hear, is the breathing, if you like, of this machine, for it is alive now.
No, you're confusing it with a Terminator. And as far as I'm aware, they don't use those for election coverage.
The swing in this constituency was 4.5%. If this was repeated across the country, it could be good news for Mr. Boris Johnson.
Oh, really? 4.5%? So what would that mean?
He'll be back.
Once the BBC had worked out that computers were not cybernetic organisms, they realised they were going to be quite handy, although even in 1979, the presenters weren't quite sure for what.
Yes, indeed, well, now, Tony, the computer's on trial in a funny way, too. I mean, do you think it's going to be the most useful tool we've ever had?
Oh, yes, beyond any question, it can do a very large number of things very quickly. It can tell us almost in an instant what the swing is in any given constituency. It can distinguish between marginal and safe seats, between rural and urban, and so on.
Hmm. Yeah, the technology to tell urban from rural seats already existed, of course. It was called a map. Fortunately, it was rapidly realised that computers could do much more than work out swings. They could illustrate them via state-of-the-art graphics. So state-of-the-art for 1987 that the system would be pushed right to its limits.
Conservatives in Southport, that may have given the Liberals the chance they wanted. Let's put the winning post in. There is the winning post for the opposition. It's not coming up for some reason. I wonder why not. Something has frozen the battleground, David, so I'm going to have to leave you there with the impression that what's happening is that the Conservatives are holding their seats right across the battleground.
I'm going to leave you with the impression that the special effects budget wasn't quite up to it. But the graphics department just kept upgrading, and election night now is like watching cutscenes from a slightly dull video game. I can't wait to see what the graphics department have in store this time round, because that's definitely where the entire TV budget goes. You can tell from what's left over for the rest of the coverage.
I'm still trying to discover what happened in Houghton and Sunderland South, because we haven't been able to produce the figures, or the share, or the change, because of apparently a microphone failure at the count, which seems rather weird. Is it not? Have anybody got it on Twitter? Have you got it on... No, you haven't got it on Twitter. Have you got it?
Let me try
no?
to get it.
Nobody's got it.
So that's David Dimbleby in 2017 asking three co-presenters with laptops wired to the BBC election results studio if any of them can find the election results on Twitter. Anyway, the 2019 election is underway, and already Donald Trump has weighed in by phoning Nigel Farage live on LBC on Thursday night. But given how spur of the moment the president is, it's lucky he phoned the right radio station.
Because Jeremy Corbyn would be so, so bad for your country. So, so bad. So bad! But Boris is a great guy. And you and him, if you got together, you could do great things. Such great things, folks.
I'm not sure we can. This is Miley in Class, and you're on Classic FM.
Classic FM. I love Classic FM. I'm a great musician, by the way. I wrote my first symphony at age 6. And I love all the types of classical music. Romantic, Renaissance, choral.
Baroque?
I hated him. I don't even think he was born in America, folks.
Next week, Vladimir Putin calls Gardner's Question Time. Thank you very much.
Our next guest is about to star in an act of God. Don't worry, it's a play. So it's a miracle she's found time to join us tonight. It's Zoe Lyons!
So this week, Samira Ahmed, the presenter of the viewer feedback programme Newswatch, started legal proceedings against the BBC for paying her a sixth of the salary Jeremy Vine received for hosting Points of View. Ahmed received £440 per episode compared to Vine's £3,000 per episode, which does seem to be a surprisingly vast discrepancy. And I can only trust that my male counterparts on the Now show today aren't getting any more than the two pork scratchings and a rule plug that I've been offered for this appearance. The BBC has argued that the shows are not actually similar, and I have to agree. It would take a total numpty not to notice that one is a 15-minute show featuring comments from BBC's viewers hosted by a woman, while the other has the completely different format of being a 15-minute show featuring comments from BBC viewers hosted by a man. I mean, come on, ladies, stop your moaning. Get back to work. Time is money. Well, obviously not quite as much money for you. This story got me thinking about a few things. It can't have been an easy decision for Ahmed to take legal action against the corporation she says she loves working for. There are the potential effects on her career, as well as the horrors of opening yourself up to the scrutiny of the British public. And we all know how fair and rational the general public can be. Just send out a tweet with the words Greta Thunberg or immigration or isn't the voting on Strictly good this year in it? And wait for the well-balanced, articulate debate to begin. Also, I personally admire Ahmed's decision to take this tribunal because I, for one, am rubbish when it comes to talking about money. I mean, honestly, I am really, really bad at negotiating. I am the only person I know who ended up paying more than the original quoted price when bartering for a piece of jewellery in a market in India. The stallholder started out proceedings at 600 rupees and I miraculously managed to close that deal at 800 rupees. I mean, in your face, Lord Sugar. But my lack of entrepreneurial skills are nothing to do with my gender. It's just harder for some people. My wife is the complete opposite to me when it comes to money. She is a ruthless businesswoman. It was with a certain amount of skewed pride that I watched her beat down on price kids selling cupcakes for charity. The reduced amount of money raised for much-needed school equipment was very much our cupcakey gain. Her skills are such that she has even suggested it would be better if I died before her, because she will definitely get a much better deal on a plot, casket and handles for me than I would ever get for her. But most importantly, this story really has got me thinking not so much about why in 2019 a woman has to take legal action to get equal pay for presenting a similar viewer feedback program, and more about the real burning issue here. Namely, who the hell still writes into viewer feedback programs? Seriously, who are these people? In a world where it feels like we are perilously close to the edge of an apocalypse caused by the combined horrors of impending climate disaster, endless political madness, and the mere existence of one or more Kardashians, who finds the time to write into the BBC to complain about the irritating mic boom in shot on Question Time, or being exposed to the unwanted sight of an aggressive badger's nipples on this week's episode of Countryfile? I mean, spare a thought for these overly sensitive people who, let's be honest, must be annoyed by the sound of their own footprints. In a way, I kind of envy them. I'd pay good money to have that much time on my hands to be able to put pen to paper at the slightest annoyance. And by good money, I obviously mean two pork scratchings and a rule plug. Thank you very much.
So, this week, the Daily Telegraph was put up for sale. It comes with a guide price of £250 million and a free bottle of water. But why now?
Press profits, party poopers, UK sales stats, heartbreak, death plunge.
It's true. You wouldn't know it from the hours of press previews and newspaper roundups and talk of election influence, but newspapers are nowhere near the force they used to be. Sales have roughly halved in the last 10 years, and printed papers are going the way of record shops, cash points and moderate MPs. It seems a shame in some ways. Where will we be without papers?
Twitter, probably, I suspect, and it won't be the same. There are some things for which a computer will never quite be a substitute.
Damn, that's another window gone.
Will you stop trying to swap flies with your iPad?
And it is quite sad in many ways. Newspapers have been part of our lives since the very first edition of The Times was published in 1788, containing a headline about Pitt the Younger and a letter from Jacob Rees-Mogg. The Daily Mail was first published in 1896, although I'm not sure it would have borne much resemblance to the modern paper.
My friend Sherlock Holmes made a regular habit after breakfast of perusing the day's newspapers. At last, he cried one morning, behold, Watson, a mystery worthy of my talents, an intriguing tale of a lady of the very highest connection, whose innermost secrets were laid open to the world by some person or persons unknown. By a cunning stratagem of her own devising, she has been able to ascertain the method by which this sullying of her reputation was effected, and thus reveal the culprit. Good Lord, Holmes, I cried. So, it was Rebecca Vardy's Instagram account.
It's been a long decline. In the 1960s, the Daily Express sold over 4 million copies a day, and now it sells 321,000, perhaps because it's still the same people buying it.
The Daily Telegraph, which dropped through my parents' letterbox every day in my teens, would have been one of 1.4 million copies sold. It currently sells 360,000. While Britain's best-selling paper for many years is, of course...
Your Super Soraway Sun.
Which sold 3.7 million copies a day in 1980, was still selling 3.1 million 10 years ago, but now sells 1.4 million.
Around 300,000 of these are actually read. The other 1.1 million are rolled up and left behind the windscreen of a white van to show traffic wardens what day it was parked.
But these are paid-for papers, of course. Since 2015, the highest circulation paper in the UK has actually been Metro, which is available free in 52 cities. But if you live in the country or you drive to work, you may never have seen it.
Yeah, if you haven't seen it, it's basically a type of seat cover for public transport. which doubles as a newspaper. It's given away free at rail and underground stations and bus stops and has news, sport, entertainment, and can also tell you the weather.
Yes, if it's scrunched in a damp pulp by the door, it's raining. Free papers, paid for by advertising, have been another reason why paid print is struggling. Another is the current occupant of the White House, who has himself contributed to the decline of newspapers this week by banning what he calls...
the failing New York Times. Just checking, we are an LBC, right?
That's right. He's banned it from the White House and ordered all federal departments to stop buying it as well, along with the Washington Post, the paper, ironically, that did more than any other to bolster the image of reporters and arguably inspired a generation of post-Watergate journalists, many of whom discovered the reality wasn't quite like the movies.
But, Chief, you've got to let me run with this story.
I can't. It's too risky.
God damn it, Chief. This is why I got into the business. People need to know the truth.
Are you sure about all these? You've double-checked every source.
It's solid, Chief. The story is solid.
Are you sure? We're about to expose which Harry Potter character you most closely resemble.
Now, some papers have opted for a paywall subscription, losing views but gaining a revenue stream. However, you can normally see the headline and the first paragraph without paying.
The headlines tonight: election gears up, climate protest, and England in the final of the Rugby World Cup. And we don't know much more than that. The budget's been cut again, and we don't have the password to read the rest.
Then the other option is the way The Guardian do it. Put your articles up for free, but then ask for a donation.
If you're enjoying this 10 o'clock news, why not make a small contribution? Just £5 will help keep Laura Koonsberg in warm overcoats through to Christmas.
The newspaper brands do survive online, of course. It's just the paper editions that are in trouble. But the brands are not going away. In fact, those brands are so deeply ingrained that one of the fastest ways for any marketing survey to categorise you is to ask...
what paper do you read?
Because the answer is immediate shorthand for a type of person, and we all know it. If I say Guardian reader, you're immediately picturing...
old newspapers go in the composting bin with the avocado skins and the fair trade tea leaves.
If I say Telegraph reader...
I use old newspapers to get the bonfire going. And then, when it's really smoky, we'll chuck the bangers in and stick the health and safety officer in the wicker man.
If I say Sun reader...
oh, so it was Rebecca Vardy's account.
And, of course, Express reader...
Why did Diana have to leave us? Shall we ever know the truth?
Thank you very much.
So our next guest is a comedian who's working on the second series of his Radio 4 show, Chinese Comedian. Would you please welcome Ken Chang?
Right.
Recently, the internet has become embroiled in one of the most hotly contested debates of all time. That's right, I'm of course talking about the debate over Marvel movies and whether they count as cinema. This debate kicked off when director Martin Scorsese told Empire magazine he doesn't think Marvel movies are cinema. Ignited a fury of many diehard fans who insisted that they are. What's that? People on the internet getting overly invested arguing over a binary yes or no question. Unbelievable in today's age. Spanish director Pedro Almodóvar came in with perhaps the strangest criticism, saying the movies are sexless and neutered. Sexless? They're movies for kids, Pedro. Look, if you want to crack one off over a movie, I'm not going to judge. But do it in the privacy of your own home, not in the cinema in a movie with a 12A certificate. Personally, I'm a fan of the Marvel franchise. I saw Avengers Endgame this year. I saw a midnight screening. Did I dress up like a nerd? I just wore my normal clothes. So yes. Endgame was a massive event, the culmination of a 22-film-long franchise, and I decided, leading up to the event, to make it my mission to rewatch all previous 21 Marvel movies. And watching these movies back-to-back, I realized, you know what? A lot of these movies suck. It's rich to say that these movies aren't cinema. The cinema is the only place I can enjoy them. I need that 60-foot screen to distract me from the abysmal writing. There's a romantic scene in Thor 2 where Natalie Portman and Thor are just about to kiss and she says to him, "I like the way you explain things." And you're just like, "Yep, that was definitely written by a man." At the same time, some of these movies are very good and actually very culturally important. Like Black Panther, for example. You can't walk out of Black Panther and say that wasn't art, mostly because it makes you sound a little bit racist. But perhaps these directors do have a point. Maybe the purity of cinema is under threat. As mentioned earlier, Netflix has just announced its new speed-up function where you can watch everything at 1.5 times the normal speed. A bit of an oversight, Netflix clearly haven't considered the potential negative side effect that makes all action chase sequences look like Benny Hill. Hardcore purists say this means you're no longer watching things how the artist intended, but personally, I'm all for this move. We're all so time poor now. I wish I had this function to speed up all tasks, like doing my tax returns or visiting relatives. It's fair to say that the commercial aspect is changing the art form, and you've got to respect Scorsese for criticizing capitalism's influence over the film industry, which he happened to do in a magazine interview designed to ensure his latest film, The Irishman, is a box office success. Even though he does have a point, the way he said it still reeks of snobbery, and that's dangerous. What if someone decides, my stand-up isn't worthy of being classed as comedy, which is something I often get already on Twitter or visiting relatives. Coming from stand-up, I'm used to having my art form looked down upon by snobs. Stand-up comedy still isn't eligible for Arts Council funding on the basis that it's not real art. Luckily, by appearing on the Now Show, I found other ways to fleece taxpayers of their money into funding my not-real art. That categorization seems short-sighted, though. Comedy has the power to inspire people, to move people, and in my opinion, so do Marvel films. At the end of the day, if people enjoy these movies, who's to decide it isn't cinema? Whether you like Marvel or not, just enjoy what you enjoy. Don't be a snob. And if you like the way I explain things, please get in touch after the show.
Now, our next guest is preparing to bring her show, The Jess Robinson Experience, to the Leicester Square Spiegel Tent. And to give us a taste of that experience, the more astute of you may have guessed, is Jess Robinson.
This week, a study claimed that individuals who exhibit traits of narcissism may be less likely to experience stress or depression. Finally, a quick fix to happiness. So with the help of practically perfect life coach Julie Andrews, here are a few tips on how to be more narcissistic. Now, children, are we sitting comfortably? Then I'll begin. If narcissism is meant to be healthy, get out your phone and take 9,000 selfies. Refer to yourself as a queen or a king. You are now one of your favorite things.
tell everyone that you're writing a screenplay. List your profession as model/DJ. Hours on Instagram growing your brand. Make your new life partner your own right hand. Someone else is stealing focus. That will just not do. Pretend that you're having a panic attack. The attention is back on you. That's right, children. You'll be a candidate on The Apprentice in no time. Psychotic, neurotic, or vapid and vain are words that they'll throw at you. Let them complain, 'cause it doesn't matter what they say or do, as long as their worlds are revolving round you. And now for your trump card. Believe that you're worthy of running a nation. Build a big wall to stop mass immigration. They'll talk of collusion, but nothing will stick. Basically, act like the world's biggest blocker. Stressed, now you're self-obsessed. You think you're all that. You also have much more free time on your hands, 'cause everyone else thinks you're a brat. God, I'm good.
Jess Robinson.
So you may have seen in the papers this week a story about a family of four, young children, booked seats on a crowded train, three-hour journey, only to find a middle-aged couple sitting in two of those seats and utterly refusing to move, which didn't seem fair. So we've asked our audience what event in their life has left them with the greatest feeling of injustice.
My train journey earlier this week. Some rude, shouty, aggressive young people with young children kept screaming at me and my wife. Something about seat bookings. Outrageous.
What's left you with the greatest feeling of injustice? I came all the way from New Zealand to live in the UK and experience post-Brexit societal collapse. And now I have to wait.
What event in your life has left you with the greatest feeling of injustice? There is no meat option in a vegan restaurant.
So thank you for sharing that therapy session with us there, everybody. Thank you for listening, and goodbye.
Goodbye. You've been listening to The Now Show, starring Steve Punt, Hugh Dennis, Josh Berry, Ken Cheng, Zoe Lyons, and Jess Robinson. It was written by the cast with additional material from Liam Byrne, Catherine Brinkworth, Gareth Gwynne, and Eleanor Morton. The song was by Jess Robinson, Steve Dunn, and Matthew Crosby. The producer was Matt Strong, and it was a BBC Studios production.